Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
Isaac Cohen of TerraMind, a business security expert, recommends taking a preventive approach to curb security-related happenings. For small businesses, that's sometimes difficult to do, but he's here today to talk about ways a small business leader can prevent incidents that have caused billions of dollars worth of troubles to large corporations. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your company, and where people can learn more about you, your website. And then when you finish, Dan Perkins here has some really interesting questions. Isaac, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me. I really appreciate it. So my name is Isaac Cohen. I'm the CEO and founder of TerraMind. TerraMind is a company that has developed a product specifically to tackle the problem of insider threats. So an organization of any size, most organizations these days anyway, have some of their staff working on computers. And the insider threat might be an employee that either does something by negligence and that turns into a threat to the business, or does something malicious. And throughout the show, hopefully, we're going to get to explore these scenarios in more detail and how we can take preventative measures. So TerraMind, as a company, has been around since 2014. We're based in New York. And we have heard hundreds, if not thousands, of different use cases, of different horror stories, different events. And through learning from our customers, we've incorporated lots of different details and features into the product that make us pretty unique. Our website is www.terramind.co. And within the website, you can see a demo of the product. You can also see a live demo dashboard, and you can talk to us, of course, on chat.
Isaac, this is Dan Perkins, and thank you for joining us today. I was listening to your response to Don's question, and something struck me that I'd like you to clarify. If I understood you correctly, Isaac, you said that the major threat comes within the corporation, as opposed to cyber attack outside the corporations?
So in order to really secure a company, you have to protect all angles. And that covers a lot, right? So that covers your typical firewalls, which protect your network from the outside. It covers, for example, human factors, for example, educating your employees not to open phishing emails. But there's one element that's often overlooked, and that's, well, what if the person that could cause the most damage to your company is already within your company and has legitimate access? So that is definitely something that has been undervalued over the years. Much of the attention in terms of cybersecurity went to viruses, malware, firewalls, things like that, which are all very, very important. But not too much attention has been given to the person who sits at the computer, who has legitimate access, and who might do something bad or by error allow someone else to do something bad. And we can give lots of examples of that in both malicious and negligent types. But in any case, I think some studies shown that around 40% of all attacks can be traced to an insider, whether by error or malicious intent.
That's just amazing. I have to tell you, Isaac, I had not given that any thought at all. I guess I was as susceptible to all the media talking about attacks from outside. It didn't cross my mind that attacks can be generated, and you're saying as much as 40% from inside.
Well, I mean,
how much I'm sorry, go ahead.
I mean, an attack from inside can be someone from outside. For example, you can have someone dropping a USB key in a parking lot of a large organization, right? Then an employee who, you know, doesn't have any ill intent picks up the USB key, puts it into their computer, and the insider, has essentially opened the back door for the outsider to get in. So that's sort of an insider threat, even though he didn't mean to do that bad thing he did, you know?
I got to figure out how to phrase this question, because it could be a little spicy. I've seen some research about how much time is spent on the internet by lots of different kinds of employees, and sometimes it's playing games, and sometimes it's pornography. And yet, I've also read that a lot of these sites that are being used on company time are, in fact, specifically designed to go after and gain access to the inside network of a company.
So there are many different use cases to a software like ours. Essentially, what we do, just to give you some background, is we collect lots of data about what the user is doing, about the user activity. We allow you to play it back, and we allow you to generate many, many alerts based on anomalous activity and lots of things in between. So one of the use cases which arise from gathering so much data is a use case that relates to productivity. What is the employee doing? And there have been companies that we've worked with that we've disabled all monitoring features and just kept the productivity features. So you can tell, for example, define which applications are productive and unproductive, and then you can see this department or this employee, how much time are they spending in social media and poker websites and so on. Then we can interfere with the user, right? So we can pop up a message saying your social media time has been exceeded for the day. And typically that educates the user to stop because there's some tracker that, tracks their time on websites that they're not supposed to be on. And that applies to phishing websites as well. For example, a website that looks just like the Gmail login, right, that captures your Gmail information. So there are ways to account for those as well within the platform. I think that's a very important point.
Isaac, what would a person, a leader of a corporation, the president, the CEO, or whatever, what would have happened or what is happening that somebody would call you and want you to come in? And number two of that question is, do you do it on a confidential basis, meaning that the people in the company don't know that you're monitoring them? So pick the first one. Why would a company call you? What kind of problems will they have?
Well,
and then let's talk about monitoring.
You picked very, very related questions, right? So the idea of privacy is extremely important in some regions of the world more than others. We work internationally, but so we do a couple of things. First of all, it's a completely self-service platform. You don't need to talk to us, especially if you're a small business. You can go online, open an account. Our security details are over there for anyone who's interested, and you're pretty much ready to go. As far as the law goes, it varies, and we never, ever, ever give law advice. But, of course, we do recommend that if you are monitoring your users on a proactive basis, then you should definitely tell them. It's really up to the corporation. We sell the product. We make users agree that they'll use it in a legal way because it is a very powerful application. As far as use cases, when we have spoken to customers, the ones that do reach out, ask for help, ask for advice, have done so for many different use cases. They've found their partners are stealing. They've found their productivity is dropped, or they're worried about an employee that's about to leave the company. They don't want to monitor. They just want to see, is this employee visiting LinkedIn and Indeed more than they used to, for example. And these are the types of things we help with, among others.
So let me ask you a question. If there's an employee who has certain access because of his use of the computer, when that employee leaves employment, should all the passwords and codes and everything be changed on all the systems that require it?
Well, that's without a doubt. There should be, unrelated to what we do, there should be very clear procedures, even for the smallest of businesses. You know, but we had a small business before. We had TerraMind, and it was just standard procedure. Whenever an employee leaves, we wipe the computer dead clean, just format the drive and start from scratch. It's really something that's critical. You don't know. Forget about the employee. Let's say you can trust the employee, right? But you don't know where they kept their passwords, which public cloud drive they kept their passwords in. And essentially, companies' value these days is its intellectual property. Even if you're a construction company, right, your email box has your customers, has your quotes, has your vendors. It doesn't have to be a tech company. So every company has some sort of intellectual property or you know, sensitive data that's worth money. And companies should do, I believe, much more than what most companies are doing today to protect that sensitive data.
Do you think that, by and large, Americans are Pollyannish in terms of trying to protecting their cyber security? Can't happen to me. Pollyanna is...
I think I got it. I think... how can I say? I think with the younger generation, we see less of that. I think there's much more education out there. Plus, you know, people are growing up with sort of a different mentality, I feel, than they used to. And I don't see it happening too much. I think, from what I understand, a much higher percentage of people are more aware specifically to cyber threats, but also losing that it can't happen to me attitude just because of society today. But that's just my personal opinion about it.
So in your current business model today, as I understand it, people go to your website and it's self-controlled. Is that a good term to use?
Yes and no. So we have actually two products, and we cater to both the small business as well as the enterprise. The small business customers tend to go with our cloud offering, where we store the data, you install the agents on the computers that you want to secure, and then everything happens by itself. And for the larger companies, we have an on-premise version where you store your own data, you keep all the control, nothing gets transferred over the internet, and it's a much more complete package for larger companies. Now, even the smaller companies that have compliance issues, for example, a dental office that has patient records, they might have compliance issues with putting that data on cloud. So even the smaller companies that have these compliance issues, they might go with our on-premise solution. But either way, both are extremely easy to deploy.
If such a thing is typical, what are the kinds of things that you see most common in small businesses that they're ignoring that they need to fix?
Good question. Overall, computers have gotten more sophisticated, right? So they've gotten more sophisticated. They got lots more software on them, and that's a good thing. There are also lots more security packages, but at the same time, the more sophisticated the computers are, the more exploits that they have naturally, right? So more complicated any piece of code is, the more bugs it has, the more holes it has to penetrate. And I think that companies can definitely do more and better than the, you know, cable modem router that they get, than the typical antivirus software that comes with HP or whatever computer that they got. Companies need to take it a step further. You don't necessarily have to hire an in-house IT guy just for this. You can definitely hire MSPs that specialize in security. It's not very expensive, and a little bit of a preventative measure can go a long way, because, you know, if a company does get hit with any type of attack, whether from inside or outside, it will cost them a lot of money in PR, in embarrassment, in lost customers, and so on.
Dan, we need to stop a moment to hear from one of our sponsors.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
We've been asked recently by a number of people, how can they listen to past shows? And if you go to recalculating.biz, you'll find a link to iHeartRadio, which will allow you to go back and listen to shows that you didn't get a chance to finish or never heard. So we encourage you to go there, recalculating.biz.
Welcome back to Recalculating, the program dedicated to American small business. Now it's time to bring together our two experts, Dan Perkins and Don Mazzella, as they discuss things that are happening now that are affecting your business success.
We're talking with Isaac Cohen of TerraMind, a business cybersecurity expert who's here to talk to us about how we can prevent some cyber criminal from getting into our computers and perhaps destroying our business.
Isaac, let me ask you if you could take a moment and do you have three or four things that's core that people should be doing to enhance their cybersecurity?
Sure. So you should definitely, first of all, look at really good antivirus software, anti-malware, one that has anti-ransomware capability. Ransomware hits many, many, many companies, especially those that are on the Microsoft Windows platform, but also others. It can be extremely costly and discouraging to be a victim of ransomware. So that's number one. Number two, even before you take care of the antivirus and ransomware, you should definitely have a backup procedure and practice that religiously. So if you are hit with ransomware, you can get away with having a two-day-old copy of your data, but you know, while you figure out whether to pay the ransomware or try to beat it or whatever. And finally, you need to address the insider threat. I think, a little bit of preventative measure can go a long way. Insiders are a company's most valuable asset and also most risky asset. Usually these go hand in hand. And one way to do that is to check out our software and see how we do it. There are other ways to handle insiders, not necessarily by software, right? So you can educate your employees which websites not to go to, which types of emails not to click on. Fourth way is by having outstanding email service. You may use Gmail, Google Apps or Outlook 365, but make sure within those platforms to enable phishing filters, to enable very strict content filters, and those can go a long way in preventing a non-malicious employee from accidentally clicking on a malicious link inside an email.
So let me ask you, if I can, Isaac, a personal question. I have most of my computer life, I've been working with Apple. I tried at one time to do a PC, and it was too hard for me, so I gave that computer to my wife, and I went back to Apple again. What's happening to me, and I've talked to Apple about it, and I'm not the only one, but I probably almost every other day, I get these emails where people say they've scanned my system and they found 942 errors. And do I want to fix it? And I say no, and yet they keep coming back. And I spoke to Apple, and Apple was saying on their particular system, I'm on the current operating system, they said that if downloading external cybersecurity actually degrades the cybersecurity that's built into Apple. So my question is, why am I keep getting all these people who say they scanned my system, and can you corrupt your own system by putting too much on?
So absolutely. First of all, when you do, if you do install anti-malware, anti-ransomware, anti-virus, you need to go with the most reputable software you can find. So generally, and you know, this is my personal opinion, I am a big Apple fan. I've been using Mac since OS X came out, I don't know, 16 years ago. They're really excellent systems, and in my personal opinion, they're much less susceptible to viruses, malware, and so on than PCs because they have excellent built-in security mechanisms. But yes, if you do download software and you do actively give the operating system permission to install that software by clicking on the open on the OK, then that software is installed with your consent on the PC, and then it can do whatever it wants. And that's a problem because these softwares can come in different forms. First of all, it can just be non-malicious. It can just pop up ads all the time. Okay, buy this, do that. Could be ads for an upgraded version of that software. Could be ads for third party. And that's annoying. And on the other hand, it can be ransomware. After all, Mac, you know, it is a computer. It has files. They can be corrupted. They can be encrypted. So that's a problem. But I definitely think that whether you're on PC or Mac or even some distributions of Linux, you have to be extremely careful with what you download. In fact, larger enterprises, larger corporations invest a whole lot of money on content filters that before the file that you download gets to your desktop, it goes through, you know, hundreds of virus checks, hundreds of malware checks to make sure that it's clean before you're given that file. Now, if only smaller businesses that don't have these, you know, these filtering software, if only they invest some time in researching whether this is reputable software, whether I want to run it on my computer that has all my sensitive data, if they make more effort in that, then, you know, computers in the smaller business will be much, much cleaner than they are.
One observation. I have a friend of mine who is a retired Navy commander, and he said to me that one of the reasons why he's not a computer expert, but a missile expert. He said that one of the reasons he believes that there is such a big problem of attacking on the PC side is that there are operating systems that Microsoft created 15, 20 years ago are still being operated, still being used. And that the convergence of all these various Microsoft operating systems, or Windows and all the other stuff, has created a collision of various forms of software that are not necessarily compatible with each other. Then Microsoft stops supporting them, and you've got these people that still have this operating system that may be outdated, and that's a part of the vulnerability. Would you agree with that?
So some parts yes, and some parts no. In fact, the operating system is one component. Most, including one of the recent ones, I forget, there's so many of them, but one of the most common forms of attack is by exploiting an application, a web server, a blog server, you know, a hole in Adobe Acrobat, in Microsoft Word. And once you exploit those, then it doesn't matter if you're running Windows 7 or Windows 10, the bug is in the software. What grants you privileged access becomes something that's not part of the operating system. Of course, there are issues with the operating system. Microsoft, so does Apple, they release regular updates, and within every update, a certain percentage, a large percentage of it, if you look at the manifest, they are, in fact, security updates. And that's good because, you know, people are always finding new holes, new bugs, and there are always engineers fixing them, and when they fix them, they create less bugs, but still they create bugs, and it's a cycle. So there will always be patches. Microsoft, like all software vendors, eventually has to draw the line and says, okay, Microsoft Windows XP is, you know, 20 years old. We can't support it anymore because we want to move on. Those of you still running XP should upgrade. And I think that's perfectly legitimate. If you're still a business running XP, the problem is not supported. Lots of software doesn't run on it. It did have a lot of problems with security. So running outdated software is definitely an issue. As far as the operating system itself being really old and then just, you know, that Microsoft built on top of it, I'm not sure if I agree with that. I could tell you that OS X from Apple is based on FreeBSD, based on BSD, which has been around for a very long time. And that's a really solid operating system. So there are always refinements, always improvements to operating systems. I don't think the age, just because, you know, they had DOS 20 years ago, which evolved to Windows, I don't think that degrades from their security.
The other thing I want to talk to you in the minutes we have left, in addition to being a money manager, I'm also an author, and I wrote a trilogy on radical Islamic nuclear terrorism against the United States. And the first book talks about various scenarios of how terrorists could use nuclear weapons to cripple the United States. And I talked about the vulnerability of what we have in around the world is cloud computing, where corporations are moving much of their data to the cloud. And in actuality, there is a huge server farm run by Microsoft outside of Chicago that has something in the neighborhood of 400,000 blade servers, or actually three power substations to run the cooling system. Are we vulnerable if there was an attack on the cloud, that many of our operating businesses who depend upon the cloud for storage, could that be a problem?
So I'll get to your question in a second. First of all, I got to say that we have a very interesting use case. It's in a pilot. I cannot say with whom, but it is an anti-radicalization use case where our purpose is to analyze email sentiment to see patterns of users visiting websites containing radicalization content, both in English and foreign languages, and to alert on that. We have pilots with both government and large corporations for that, but that is another use case, a very big one too. To answer your question about an attack on the cloud specifically, it would definitely affect businesses, especially those that rely on the cloud. And not all businesses do, right? Some businesses have local exchange server, and that's their email server. Some businesses, like mine, use Google Apps. And it's a problem because it is in the cloud. Now, what we can rely on is that, I can't speak for Microsoft, but definitely Google, most likely Amazon, do have lots of redundancy in place. So for the 400,000 blade servers they have outside of Chicago, I'm sure that a good part of it is backed up, especially in their cloud services. Now, if you are a small business and you do use the cloud, whether you have virtual machines on Azure or on AWS, these services offer backup services, and the backup service is in a different geographic location. You should definitely take advantage of it. It's not expensive. So that if something does happen, God forbid, then at least you would have your data, and within a few hours you can restore your business to normal working state.
So you believe that the 400,000 blade servers for the cloud for Microsoft in Chicago are backed up by another 400,000 some other place in the country?
There are two types of cloud services that can be divided in two ways. One of them is self-service, where you get a cloud computer, you get cloud storage, you do whatever you want with it, and then backup responsibility is on you. The second one is whether you use the cloud for things like Outlook 365. For sure, Outlook 365, without even checking, I can tell you that it's backed up in multiple geographic locations.
Okay.
The data that you put specifically in the Chicago region of Azure, I'm just going based on what you said, that the responsibility to back that up would be yours because, it's resources. You're paying for one resource in Chicago, not one resource in Chicago and one in Seattle. So you would need to back that up. And it's also wise to do so for high availability, for redundancy. So you minimize your downtime when something does happen.
So let's just make sure that everybody gets your email or your website address, please, Isaac.
Sure. It's www.terramind.co.
Well, Isaac, thank you for your informative discussion with us. We really appreciate it. And, I know I learned some things, and I hope our listeners did. So thank you for being with us today.
Thanks very much for having me. My pleasure. Take care.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Isaac Cohen of TerraMind, a business cybersecurity expert. A link to his website will appear on recalculating.biz with an archive of this program.
Dan Perkins here from recalculating.biz with your featured book. I want to tell you about a recent interview I had with Bob Bethel, a turnaround specialist with lots of success in small business. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. He tells us of his life successes and failures that have made him and his clients so successful. Over the years, Bob has brought 77 companies back from the brink and changed them into thriving, profitable businesses. His energy is amazing, and at 74, he proves that you can still have a great deal to give others if you just try. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. One insight struck me was that most companies do not have a plan. The old Chinese proverb says, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there, is true today. Bob Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating.biz featured book.
In New York this week, 500 managers and bankers from across the fintech world met to discuss the rising use of online financial resource companies. It was the latest of a number of such conclaves across the country. What does it mean for small business leaders? Speaker after speaker droned on about the funds available to grow their small businesses. Other panels talked about the ease such companies are making the loan process. Finding the money to grow can be as short as an hour. Some speakers said the average was 3 days versus going to a more traditional banking resource, which could take up to 3 months. But as one speaker pointed out, small businesses can suffer in one way from the fintech revolution. The personal banking touch that puts the small business leader in physical proximity to the banker, that personal touch that can come in handy should growth plans not work out exactly as expected, is not there. There is an old saying, when you owe enough to the bank, you own the bank. Most banks won't let that happen, but having a personal relationship can ease some issues. Fintech bankers are about doing everything over the internet. For those times when the small business succeeds, this works great. But what happens if they don't? It's harder without that personal touch.
With Halloween decorations already up, can Christmas be far behind? Chris Francis, VP of Market Development at Worldpay US, is here to talk about ways every small business can add profit to this holiday season. Chris, welcome to the program. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your business, your website, and how this holiday season can mean more profits for our small business listeners.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Don. So my name is Chris Francis. As you had mentioned, I'm in market development here at Worldpay US. Worldpay US is the U.S. division of one of the largest payment processors in the world, and we service, in the United States anyway, well over 100,000 small businesses providing payment processing services, going directly from the traditional swipe machines, or now the EMV machines that folks can insert their cards into, all the way up into the fully integrated point-of-sale systems as well as e-commerce and online presences. So our website is at worldpay.com. Since we are a global company, you do want to make sure you use the U.S. link to see what the U.S. payments services are available for you. So that being said, as you had indicated in your intro, Christmas is just about upon us. I can't believe it's already October now, but here we are, and that holiday season is really starting to ramp up. And now is a really good time for any small business owner to really start reviewing not only any training schedules or making sure that their staff are up to date with all of the latest things going on within that location, but also to go ahead and start looking ahead as well as reviewing last year's holiday season. There are a number of different insights that folks can glean from what happened last year, both good and bad, opportunities for improvement and things to prevent. But then also what we see in the marketplace here at Worldpay is that everything is really driving towards mass customization, meaning that each consumer is wanting to feel special. They're wanting to get what they want when they want it. And in our opinion, a lot of the small business operators out there are really in a position to know their customers well and to be able to deliver those custom goods and services in ways that a lot of the larger retailers just aren't able to do.
Chris, this is Dan Perkins. Thank you for joining us today.
No, thank you for having me.
Sure. I want to ask you a question. Actually, it's a multi-part question. We are in the United States today transitioning from a traditional plastic card to a chip card. And some places differentiate between credit and debit. I was just in Lowe's this morning, and I have a debit card, but it has a chip in it. And they say, well, if it's a debit card, even if it's got a chip in it, you got to go through this, you got to swipe it. And if it's a credit card, it has to go into the credit card slot, the chip slot. So how are we as far as in putting in what I have been told a better security chip card readers? Are we, what kind of progress are we making with that?
It's as any card accepting retailer out there can tell you, it's been a brutally painful process. So we're just about 2 years into that chip card migration here in the States. It's funny you should ask, because I was just reading an article that came out this morning indicating that only about 2/3 of retailers today even accept the chip cards. Many of the rest are still on magstripe, and there are a variety of reasons for that. But at the end of the day, this is the way that most of the rest of the world has gone. This is the way that the United States is going. And the card associations have put into place incentives or punishments, as some might view, to retailers to try to adopt the technology when they can. There are certain classes of retailers who are not able to, or like the chain that you had mentioned, are having some challenges in terms of implementing some of the U.S.-specific things. And the debit networks that we have in the United States is very unique to the United States. Most of the rest of the world doesn't have those sorts of things, so they haven't had the same problems that we've had. So we're getting there. It's taken a lot longer than anyone would have liked. I figure it's probably going to be another couple of years until we have a really full coverage in terms of the devices that are out in the marketplace for merchants to be able to use. The one thing I do want to caution retailers about, though, is that the incentives that are, or punishments that are in place, are in the form of what is known as chargebacks, meaning that a consumer can dispute a transaction, and the issuers oftentimes can dispute transactions that they feel are due to fraud in some way, shape, or form. And the incentive for merchants to adopt the chip cards is that if a counterfeit card is used, the magstripe is very easily counterfeited. It's the exact same technology as a cassette tape that when I was a kid I used to record things on over and over and over again. If a magstripe is counterfeited and that card had been issued with a chip and the merchant accepts it, then the merchant will be liable for that chargeback, full stop. They will not have any representment rights. And there had been some significant pain in the retailing community back in October 2015 when this liability shift, as it's known, first took place. And so the card associations did specify that any transactions under $25 would not be subject to that liability shift. So a lot of folks with small average tickets, they're not feeling that pain right now, even if they haven't upgraded to the EMV devices. The reason why I say that they shouldn't delay is that in April of 2018, that $25 limit is due to expire. So I just want to make sure that anyone out there who hasn't had a significant number of chargebacks and don't have the chip card accepting devices, they do want to be aware of that April 2018 date, because if they could be subject to some heavy losses following that.
So is the reason why America was behind the rest of the world was because of America's love affair with its debit cards?
Actually, compared to a lot of the rest of the world, we're more in love with credit than we are with debit. Most of the rest of the world doesn't have the credit card mindset that the United States has. But back to your question, part of the reason why we are behind is because for so many years we have had a functioning, relatively efficient, and relatively inexpensive infrastructure to process payment transactions. So what had happened is that every merchant pretty much has to accept credit cards nowadays. You see them in vending machines, you see them in unattended parking, and the size of the U.S. marketplace is such that the physical cost, both to the issuers, and there are hundreds of issuing banks out in the United States, as well as to the merchants for upgrading the hardware was so massive that it was delayed. And there are other countries that were able to go first. The first country that converted to these chip cards was Britain back in 2004. And just to give a comparison of the size of the marketplace, there were six big banks in Britain that pretty much controlled the payment processing. Britain is the number two marketplace in the world for credit cards, or at least it was for many, many years. I haven't seen the China numbers lately. But it was dwarfed in size by the United States, and the telecommunications infrastructure was a lot more expensive. So there were a lot more things that were pushing the UK towards the chip acceptance that made it a lot more financially viable. In the United States, because it is such a competitive marketplace with all the players and everything was working pretty well, those are the main reasons, the massive cost and the lack of ROI compared to some of the other regions in the world. That's the reason why we're kind of bringing up the rear as far as this technology is concerned.
If I'm a mom and pop ice cream store, I live on Sanibel Island, so we sell a lot of ice cream here, and we've got several single-only ice cream stores. What does it cost them to make the switch to the new chip technology, the readers? Is it an expensive proposition for them?
So that's going to be a little bit of a loaded question. So I'll answer that as best as I can. And part of that is that the payments processing world is far more complex than anybody could ever imagine, far more complex than I would ever have imagined when I started doing it 25 years ago. But if you are talking about a traditional standalone terminal that everyone's used to, where you insert the card or swipe the card, it dials out or uses the internet to connect, prints out the receipt, those machines are relatively inexpensive. You can usually swap out your old machine for a new one for a few hundred dollars at most. If you're talking about an integrated point of sale, and there are many, many of them out there, and they're flourishing now thanks to cloud computing, as your previous guest was talking about. If you are talking about any sort of an integrated point of sale, it could be a little bit more expensive because there very well may be some point of sale hardware or software upgrades that are required to get to the version that supports the chip technology, and there may be an additional device that you'd have to purchase. So a lot of times, it is going to be dependent upon what a merchant has installed, and we usually recommend that they talk to both whomever their current processor is as well as their local dealers who are servicing and supporting those point-of-sale systems.
So would you be a competitor of Visa and MasterCard, or how would you classify yourself?
So we are what's known as there are multiple terms in our industry. It's very funny how that works. But we are a processor or an acquirer. And so what that means is everyone is familiar who the issuers are. The issuers are the folks who give the credit cards to individuals and guarantee that so long as the card is used legitimately, the merchant is going to be paid for those transactions. And then if the cardholder stiffs the bank, then they go after them in small claims court and ruin their credit and do all the other things that they need to do. On the other side, there are acquirers who perform the same functions for merchants in that they say that Visa and MasterCard, we are going to be responsible for this merchant. They are going to be a good player. They're not going to be a terrorist or a money launderer, and they are not going to charge cardholders unnecessarily or improperly. And if they do, going back to those chargebacks I was talking about before, we actually pay the fines to Visa and MasterCard to make the cardholders whole, and then we have to deal with our customers to get our money back. So Visa and MasterCard really, and to a lesser extent American Express and Discover, they really set up the rules of the game as far as who has what responsibilities, who has what rights. The issuers are responsible for managing the cardholders, and the acquirers and the processors are responsible for enabling the merchants to accept cards and making sure that they follow the rules. Hopefully that makes sense.
We're listening to Chris Francis, VP of Market Development at Worldpay US. He'll be back with us after this brief message.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
Dan Perkins here for Songs and Stories for Soldiers with your veterans tip of the day. Did you know that the suicide rate for women vets is 12 times that of their sisters in civilian life? Did you know that 1 in 4 women vets feel uncomfortable about talking to people about their mental health issues? Did you know almost 600,000 women vets in America are suffering from PTSD? It's time to help. It's time for all of us to encourage our sisters, mothers, and wives to get help by contacting their local VA hospital, clinic, or community-based health care center. So if you know a woman vet that is suffering, go to va.gov and find their nearest VA facility. This has been Dan Perkins of Songs and Stories for Soldiers.us with your veterans tip of the day.
Welcome back to Recalculating, the program dedicated to American small business. Dan Perkins and Don Mazzella.
We're back with Chris Francis, VP of Market Development at WorldPay US. Dan, back to you.
Thanks, Don. Chris, let me, in the time we have left, let's talk about what's going on today. If you look around, you've got to be seeing a significant contraction in the big box stores all over the nation. I saw a report from the Retail Merchants Association. They think by the end of 2017, over 8,500 storefronts will have been closed in the United States. And yet we have an economy that seems to be recovering under Mr. Trump with jobs and productivity and actually increases in GDP and wages. So what are you looking for, not so much for Halloween, with Christmas being such an important part of the retailer's business, what are you planning for Christmas 2017?
Well, what we're seeing, and in the numbers that you had discussed, I think it's kind of borne out. What we're seeing is consumers are really focusing on convenience and on retailers who understand them. And so a lot of that traffic and a lot of that business is moving online. We definitely are seeing a huge uptick in online activity, both for the traditional internet giants as well as a lot of the local entities servicing their customers. We're also seeing some pretty good movement in some of the smaller, more boutique environments, whether it is in retailing or in food and beverage or things along those lines, where they are providing specific, unique, niche goods and services to their customers, goods and services that those customers expect. And I think we're going to see that trend continuing. It's the folks in the middle, primarily the typical department stores, the large environments that service a wide variety of different customers that are probably going to have the hardest time getting that mind share and that value add and the share of the wallet. So that combined with the fact that because of cloud computing, because of the shift to chip technologies and some other trends that we're seeing in the marketplace, there are a lot of different players that are coming out with ever narrower and ever more specific solutions for retailers to be able to provide more customized services to their customers, whether that is push marketing, whether that is mobile apps that can be created and deployed relatively cheaply, whether that is new forms of payment or accepting e-commerce payments and delivering in store. There are a lot more options for retailers out there for a lot less expense than there ever have been. Now, since we're at October, it's probably going to be pretty late for folks who haven't already started working on that to get started working on that. And again, if you're talking about an integrated point of sale system or general ledger or anything along those lines, a good first step would be to talk to the current providers and say, hey, you know, what other offerings are out there? How else can you help enable me to work with my customers and to reach out to them and to understand what it is that they're looking for? From a small business perspective, I think that's got to be where folks have got to focus, understanding who their customer are, what they're looking for, what is it that makes you better than your competition, and then really trying to focus on that and to make that more widely available. Another good way to do that is via some of the shop local holiday campaigns. I live in the Metro Atlanta area, which is where our U.S. headquarters is, and there's this great tradition in downtown Roswell, a nice little town in the northern suburbs. On Thursday nights, during the spring, where all the merchants band together, they do marketing, they have discounts, and this little town of downtown Roswell is just absolutely bustling on those Thursday nights. So, you know, trying to be creative like that and bring folks into your shop, whether you're partnering with some of your compatriots or not, is really going to be crucial to the success of a lot of the small business retailers.
You know, Chris, I told you I was at Lowe's this morning, and I was looking for the possibility of some custom-made paint. I couldn't find anybody, and I mean I couldn't find anybody in the store who could service me. And I finally went to the service desk, and I said, is there anybody that can help me with paint? And the person at the service desk said, I'll make a page. I don't know whether they were hiding or not, because yesterday I was in Macy's here in Fort Myers, and you could walk through the store and you could see a smattering of customers, but nobody was at the cash registers and nobody was on the floor. You know, and I look at that, and I remember writing a commentary about big box stores versus the internet. The internet, I guess, has figured out how important it is to have good customer service. And the big box stores have forgotten what it means to have customer service. So I can see the shift continuing away from big box stores to the internet. And I suspect we're going to have a very large and successful Christmas season for the online retailers, not so much for the big box stores.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that sentiment. And it's funny because I, even though I'm in Atlanta, you know, and we are a Home Depot town, I do patronize the Lowe's as well. And that's an unusual and disappointing experience. But I think it also is indicative of exactly what you said, and that's absolutely right. And again, there is that opportunity for the small business retailer. There are tools that are available nowadays to let folks know what you have in stock, or to help folks get it in stock. I was at a conference 2 weeks ago up in Long Island, New York, and there was a retailer from the New Mexico region. They have two stores. They had one in Albuquerque, and the other one was down south, about a four-hour drive south. And the store in Albuquerque was their flagship store. It was very large. The one down south in Las Cruces, I believe it was very, very small comparatively, and they offer unique products. And their customers would go into the southern store, and they couldn't find the products, and they would get frustrated. So they implemented an online ordering system relatively inexpensively, where the folks down in Las Cruces could look at the inventory, see if it was in stock. If it wasn't in stock, they would put in an order real quick, and the website would come back and tell them when it would be available. Would it be later that day? Would it be tomorrow? Would it be in 2 days? So that the they can help service their customers better. They're already running product between the two locations, but it allowed them to plan it out better and to make sure that they would be able to service their customers. And that was being used via a cloud-based service with one of Worldpay's partners, where they focus on handling that inventory management for their customers. With the power of the cloud and the costs that have come down, there are lots of opportunities for players to come in and offer some niche products like that to help out the small business retailers, so they don't have to make the massive investment in the IT systems and the expertise and the programming, but they can still offer some of these really unique and really customized services to their customers. The only caution I would have is that make sure that you understand all of the costs, make sure how it will impact your processes, your customer service. They will change something, and you want to make sure you understand that and plan for it to make sure that the customer experience is always going to be as good as possible, because that's going to be the differentiator, and I don't see that changing any time in the foreseeable future.
Do you think that the debit card will expand or contract? Are we more now interested because the economy is better of getting credit versus spending our own money?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and over the past 10 or 15 years or so, debit has really been growing dramatically compared to credit, and in some cases has been eating into the share of transactions from a payment transaction standpoint. I've seen some studies lately that are indicating that the usage of debit may have peaked in the United States in lieu of some of the other more non-traditional products, be they prepaid cards, be they e-commerce wallet types of payments, things like that. I'm not sure if I believe that or not. Debit is a great budgeting tool for folks who have gotten into trouble with credit cards in the past, and I don't see that ever changing, especially with the fact, well, conversely, a lot of the banks are issuing credit cards to folks that they wouldn't have following 2008. So we'll see. I kind of am on the fence about that. And from a business owner's perspective, for most folks, debit cards are good because they're cheaper unless your average ticket is below $15 or $17 or so. From a consumer perspective, I prefer any product that helps folks stay out of debt. So I think there's going to be a mix. I think debit is going to continue to rise, probably slower than it has been, but it is going to go up and down based upon the economy, the strength of the issuing banks, the risk profiles that they have, and who knows what's going to happen with the very large data breach from another company here in Atlanta recently. If banks start having problems with being able to authenticate folks that they want to issue credit cards to because of the data that's out there, they very well may slow down on the issuing there, which would obviously mean debit would pick up a little bit faster.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. So, Chris Francis, give us your website again.
Our website is worldpay.worldpay.com. And again, you'll want to make sure you select the U.S. region, unless you're looking for products in the rest of the world, in which case, feel free to peruse those as well.
Well, we've been talking with Chris Francis, Vice President of Market Development at WorldPay. Chris, thank you for joining us. It was a great interview.
Oh, thank you so much. I enjoyed it very much.
We've been talking with Chris Francis, VP of Market Development at WorldPay US. He's given us some ideas how small businesses can prepare for this holiday season. A link to his website will be on our webpage, www.recalculating.biz. Also remember, our shows are all archived at recalculating.biz. If you missed some portion of this interview and want to hear more of the guests who have been on our show, go to recalculating.biz.
Dan Perkins here with your Recalculating Small Business Tip of the Day. You know what spilled milk smells like in a few days in a hot car? Many small business people use their trucks or cars as transportation for them and, in some cases, employees. It's also a place to do business and you want to keep it clean. I have a builder friend that took a new employee to a job site who packed his lunch. At lunchtime, he bought a carton of milk to go with his sandwich. One day, the worker didn't finish the milk and set the bottle on the floor. When he shut the door, the milk fell over and spilled on the floor and sat there for the rest of the day, and then the employee returned and noticed that the milk had been spilled. My friend tried everything to get out that foul smell, but after spending a considerable sum on carpet cleaners, eventually he had to replace the carpet. Make sure you carry at least one roll of paper towels. Those you save may be your own. Check out recalculating.biz for more useful small business suggestions. This has been Dan Perkins with your small business tip of the day.
Dan, what do you have to say about today's guests and their ideas?
Well, interesting. We had a guy who was in charge of cybersecurity and a guy who's trying to get us to use our debit and credit cards. I thought it was an interesting pairing. I think that there are changes taking place in the credit card industry. I don't know that debit's going out the window. I find that as I got older, I paid down my credit card debt and now just use my debit card whenever possible because I just don't want to carry a bunch of debt anymore. But that's maybe because I'm older. I thought that our cybersecurity guest really did a great job of trying to help us understand what's going on. Isaac Cohen from TerraMind gave us a lot of good information about what's going on and helping us understand what we need to do as small business people for handling our security, and we need to do that. So I thought they were two good guests, and we're going to do this again next week, and please come and join us.
Goodbye, Dan, and to our audience, have a good week.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.